Well, thank you very much. It's an absolute pleasure to speak to you today. And hopefully, as Bob mentioned, give you a little bit of a flavor of why multinational companies are very interested now in the work that you have been doing for your entire careers. With, of course, the understanding that we may be a lot lower on the learning curve than you are, but hopefully you'll tell us. As Bob mentioned, there's a lot of acquisition activity in this space, as they say in the investment banking world. Seems to be the drug companies are selling. I guess the other interesting lecture would be, why are they selling these businesses? I can't speak to that, so you'll have to ask them. I can only speak to why we're buying them. This is no big magic, really. This is sort of common sense, which is that we, like everybody else, understand that we, like everybody else, are getting older. Healthcare is a luxury good in the world, and as with other luxury goods, increasing consumption of that. And healthcare is also a very inefficient place. The whole rationale, of course, for this conference is to help make it more efficient. And so there are a lot of opportunities, at least from a distance, to start changing some of these things. And all of this is with the winds of just tremendous biologic science, at our backs. So that's, I think, the sort of the fundamental appeal. It's worth pointing out that this is really a global business. As you can see here on these slides, Asia Pacific is in fact the largest growth area, and I think what you're going to see, and what we've already seen in the imaging world, is these are in fact, to be efficient in these kind of businesses, you really do need a global scale to get some of these price points lower. This just illustrates the scale of Siemens Med, 40,000 employees worldwide. I think if you looked at somebody like General Electric or Philips, they could have an equally sort of detailed map of global presence. As was sort of pointed out, we have been involved in sort of saying, there's prevention, early detection, there's diagnosis, both in vitro, in vivo, and then sort of, the ongoing therapy and care. And, this is the Bayer and DPC purchases are really part of a pattern to really enrich this. CTI is a molecular imaging company. PET scans, I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. And Shared Medical was the at the time the largest independent healthcare IT vendor in the world when that was purchased. All of this, we're going to talk mostly about science today because it's 45 minutes and you can't totally get in every reason to do this. But clearly that's sort of the conundrum of cost quality is driving much of what goes on in healthcare. And I think people who look at this are pretty optimistic that they can both lower the cost and improve the quality. That this is not a zero, this is absolutely not a zero-sum game, so I would keep that in mind as well. Elias Zerhouni, the head of the NIH, really has, I think, outlined where we want medicine to be. For it to be predictive, to be preventive, and to be personalized. So instead of, here's your hypertension pill, it's the same pill we use for everybody, take yours, that we really have a much more individual molecular basis for this. And we're early in this, and this is going on, but that's really the end goal of this. The first interesting maybe news in this in some ways is this is actually starting to happen on a population basis. This was an article from JAMA 2 years ago, and this group of researchers was able to show for the first time that the average LDL in the United States population is dropping. So finally, the sort of chain of science, this is Conrad Bloch won the Nobel Prize for figuring out the synthesis of cholesterol, all the way from this discovery to the synthesis of statins to the start of statin therapy, and now, probably 25% of somewhat older adults are on statins, has finally actually changed our population lipids on average. And as you know, this is no mean feat in a world of supersizing. So we're sort of swimming upstream. But it gives a hint of the molecular basis of medicine and the impact that that's going to have. What's driving all of this? What can we say about the future? I think Yogi Berra has the same quote, prediction is extremely difficult, especially about the future. But I'm going to venture forth on that. And I think the most probably the most powerful thing here is something called Moore's Law. Gordon Moore, one of the three founders of Intel. In 1965, in an article in the April issue of Electronics Magazine, so this is the very early days of integrated circuits, individual transistors, integrated circuits, predicted that integrated circuits were invented about 5 years earlier, the very first ones, that computer power was going to double roughly every 18 months all the way out to 1975 is what his prediction was. And as we now know, this is from the Intel website, this is still true. So it is probably the most stunningly accurate prediction that has ever been made in technology. It was both qualitatively and quantitatively precise. Moore's Law is what's driving this conference and almost everything that is high-tech in medicine. And as long as this happens, and Intel believes, and the chip manufacturers believe they can deliver on this for at least another decade, we are going to have, as an absolute guarantee, changes. And if you look at all of modern imaging is really driven by computers, and all of the genomics, proteomics, everything that's sort of very high-tech is also fundamentally... the growth of that is driven by Moore's Law in computing. Because if you think back, we've actually known a lot of the wet chemistry. I mean, Watson and Crick's article now is over 50 years old. So this is not new knowledge, about the genome. It's just, the computer power to do the wholesale analysis. MRI, Felix Bloch and Edward Purcell, who discovered MRI, known back then as nuclear magnetic resonance, the radiologists didn't want to have to explain to every patient they weren't going to glow, so they had to get the word nuclear out of there. It took them 1 year after this became clinically available to figure out that was not a winning conversation. Power of euphemism. This technology is now over 60 years old. So very, very interesting, very dynamic growth. And again, it's sort of, there are lots and lots of ways of looking at these structures. I mean, probably DNA and the various microarrays are the most powerful, but there are many ways of doing it, and they're all computers, even obviously to the point of the microarrays, looking like chips. What's going to happen here? Well, on the in vitro side, here's a picture from the New England Journal on the regulation of cell death, apoptosis. This is a lot of regulation for dying. You'd think it would be pretty straightforward. There are a lot of compounds here. I don't think they had this many compounds when I was in med school, period. But, there are increasingly going to be commercial assays for this. And this picture, not any individual analyte, but this picture is really going to be the type of stuff we use for diagnosis. This is extremely interesting when you're a GE or Siemens looking at this space, this is a new world out there, very enticing. It's worth also reminding ourselves that we don't actually have to know everything about DNA. We don't have to sequence your DNA or my DNA or every protein or every intermediary metabolite. Even small pieces of information give a lot of value. So partial knowledge is powerful, so there's a path forward. That's systems biology. That's omics. I think this audience knows a lot about that. Let me go for those of you who probably maybe are not quite as familiar with what's been happening in the radiology world. Let me tell you a little bit about that. So this is Conrad Röntgen. Proud to say he actually purchased his X-ray tube from Siemens. He did complain the price was high. We actually have a little framed letter. Good quality. The price was too high. But this is what he used it for. This is the first X-ray. Now we know to take the rings off and the jewelry off, get the bling off before you do the picture. But the first X-ray, so this was in 1895. If you look at a modern digital plain film, not all that different, right? There's a lot more computer power behind it, but not fundamentally different, not diagnostically that much more different. But now if you go the next step in computing, This is, and I apologize if this doesn't show up all that well, this is a 16 or 64 slice computerized tomograph of the hand where you can, you know, visualization software has pulled out all of the arteries. So all of a sudden now we are getting something that is really qualitatively very different, but still an X-ray. And the power of resolution, just as in your field, I think one of the earlier speakers, I think Dr. Jackson, had shown, you know, in the last 50 years, the number of lab tests that are possible has gone up by a factor of 50. Well, in sort of a somewhat similar time, this is one of the early CT scans, didn't show much, but believe me, this beat out drilling a hole in your head or doing a pneumoencephalogram hands down as a diagnostic strategy. And now you have just incredible resolution with, you know, a 50 or 100-fold, probably actually a several thousand-fold increase when you really do the math on the revolution here. So a huge expansion of data. And as with omics, as with DNA microarrays that analyze all 25,000 genes or all, you know, 600,000 or 500,000 single nucleotide polymorphisms, what is very similar in the lab world and the radiology world is we are now dealing with very high dimensional data, very, very high dimensional data. And this is probably the single biggest parallelism between the lab world increasingly and the radiology world increasingly. If you had 40 slices on a scan in the mid-90s, you could read that, and they were mostly read on film. You know, the X-ray, you know, throw it up, right? You always knew who the radiologist was as opposed to anybody who might be an imposter, because the radiologist could flip that film up and it would stick on the view box under those little pins. You just that flick of the hand. I think that was the main motor scale. You know, now you can't do that because there are thousands of images, all of which were acquired in a minute. So you need computers to do this. And I think you're going to see in the lab world the same transition. There are just going to be too many analytes. They're not going to be the individual, oh, they're hypo or hypernatremic. It's going to be a pattern. So high-dimensional data. Now, pathology and lab world, I think, has always been good about integrating data results and distributing them. In the imaging world, we've been pretty bad about it, right? You know, in the imaging world, it's mostly been, here's your picture, and we really haven't had to synthesize much. But as the richness of these ways, the number of ways we can look at the heart now is stunning. I mean, multiple different ways of figuring out, do you have coronary artery disease or what the cardiac function? So now we actually have to combine all of these, and this is really where the software comes in. So we're combining CT, MR, multiple forms of echo, multiple forms of nuclear, PET scans, as well as, of course, you know, classic things like EKG and hybrids like electrophysiology. So we're really integrating these images and information. And again, the imaging requires IT. You cannot do imaging, modern imaging, without tons of information technology. And so here you can see the coronary artery bypass. This is a 64 slice scan of a heart. You know, you squirt in some dye and you take this picture. And this is all computerization software, right? These are not the slices, the sort of the more native data. This is volume and surface rendered, lots of computer power to do this picture. And but, you know, the resolution is pretty stunning. I mean, when you look at this, I mean, you know, it's just spectacular. The data, of course, can be manipulated. So if you look, here's a stent, and here's soft plaque right there and there. I don't know how clearly visible that is. This is that same data. It's just reformulated in what's called multiplanar reformulation. There's lots of different ways of formulating this where you can actually take the very curved coronary arteries and just make them into a string pretty much and look at them as a straight string to look for that. Pretty stunning. And this is early data, but you know we've had a lot of talk about here, some talk about troponins and cardiac enzymes. These are going to be the complements. There's research going on right now to, with a single set of cardiac enzymes and one of these to discharge people from the ER for chest pain. So none of the admit, none of the soft rollout, none of the repeat tests, just one-stop shopping. the quality of these joint information of lab tests and imaging can be that powerful. And that's just what I've just shown you is just looking at it, right? There's still the human interpretation. As the algorithms get more sophisticated, you can actually start doing computer-aided detection and diagnosis. This is, we have a computer-aided diagnosis group. We have 20 PhDs in machine learning. It's pretty sort of pretty big brain trust of guys. And they've come up with, and you know, the other companies are doing similar things, come up with ways of taking this very high-dimensional data, and in this case, looking at very small areas, lymph nodes, and figuring out, is this likely to be a cancer or not? And this is the type of learning you, of course, need in things like DNA microarrays, because the amount of data is really beyond human cognition. So that is absolutely out there and sort of an appeal. Another area where I think the large companies see a merging of interest between the lab world and the imaging world is on the question of scale. Historically, the things I showed for the most part, that scale was anatomic scale. Here's an organ, here's a bone, here's an artery. You folks, I think, have always lived on a molecular scale, on a cellular scale. You know, here's, you know, the Coulter counters running through, you know, cells one at a time, individual analytes. Imaging now is starting to get into that molecular scale. So we've gone from the sort of the anatomic things, you know, CT scans. You know, most CT scans, at first blush, you can't, you know, while in some ways they're extremely precise, in other ways they're a little bit imprecise, right? You can't actually, for example, tell whether the patient's alive or dead, which you would think on a medical test would be a helpful kind of thing. Sometimes you can't tell that when you're in the ER. That's always scary. We have some ways of dealing with that. But, you know, the precision is really anatomic. And now we're starting to see MRI has a physiologic component to it. But as we're getting into PET scans, we are now looking at a molecular level, and there's all kinds of interesting science on fluorescence, you know, labeled cell lines, a huge, you know, in the animal lab world on, you know, getting imaging at the individual cell level. And so we are seeing this merger of anatomic and molecular diagnosis. Let me show you a little bit of sort of how that's coming at it, not from the lab world, but from the imaging world. So this is PET scanning. CT PET fusion. So these are actually lined up. This is one that, you know, I think, you know, all of the big manufacturers have these. So you have the CT and the PET scanner in line, so there's no misalignment problem, and then you merge the images. And so you take what, if you just had a nuclear study, we'll show in a second, would be pretty unclear localization. Is it a lymph node? Is it in the adjacent tissue? Not good enough localization to operate on. By superimposing these things, you know exactly where these handful of cancer cells are and what you need to operate on. And so this world is sort of increasing to merge that. You know, here, so you can see malignancy right there. And it's just much clearer than if you just had the nuclear study, which, you know, for those of us who are just ER docs, you know, and primary care docs, we always under our breath used to call unclear medicine, as opposed to nuclear medicine, because we'd look at the pictures and we'd be, you know, confused. But with the CT projection, it's a lot less confusing, a lot more certain. And this is happening not just on the diagnosis, but on the treatment side. I don't know if any of you have a chance to follow radiation therapy. I mean, radiation therapy now is sort of like our military. I mean, they can drop bombs of radiation onto just very precise cells. With image modulated, you know, these intensely modulated image guided radiation therapy now, proton beams, the things that are coming out, you can really almost on a cell by cell basis kill the target, which allows you to be much more effective in killing bad cells and yet spare all the good tissues that we need to have good quality of life. Again, all defined by Moore's law. And both, you know, we and GE purchased Amersham, very large company, are very interested in increasing the number of biomarkers. And I think some of you may in your research lives and commercial lives also be interested in the business of taking biomarkers that maybe the classic FDG in PET, not that specific, and making it much more specific here in this case, hopefully for Alzheimer's disease. So again, that sort of cellular basis that's coming together, at that molecular level, combining imaging and molecular analytes. This, I'm showing you, is the first image in the world of merging a PET scan and MRI. From last winter, we are, in pre-release, as they say, not yet FDA approved, but we are shortly going to be coming out with an integrated MR PET scanner. So if you're looking to study the brain and what goes on in the human mind, extraordinarily powerful tool, merge technology, again, that theme of multiple information flows mediated by information technology merging together. The trick here, of course, is, as you know, the magnetic resonance imaging, the MRIs, are pretty powerful magnetic fields. If you're having small particles flying around, like the positron emission, it's a real trick to get them to fly in the direction you want in big magnetic fields. So that's the science juice, and it's taken quite a while to work that. What's interesting to me, skip the science. Sometimes it's just pattern recognition. Sometimes you look at things and you say, gee, those two things look similar. Now, this is a somewhat staged picture, but would folks agree that these in vivo boxes, aka imaging systems, look not all that dissimilar than these in vitro boxes? I would submit to you that each of these have about the same amount of computing power in them, about the same amount of networking power in them, probably very similar amounts of incrementally added clinical information to them. It's pretty interesting, but all of them really are as much about the information technology as they are about the wet chemistry or, the wet pathology. That's probably not a term that you folks use, but as they are in the imaging world about the picture or the camera. So how do you combine this stuff? If IT were easy, wherever Bruce is wouldn't need this conference, right? We're here, and I was at HIMSS 2 weeks ago. IT is hard, right? This is just hard stuff. This is not easy. This is not just plugging electricity into the wall. That's why we're here. That's why all of you are here as opposed to on the gambling floor. I see just about every single seat taken. This stuff is hard. I don't know if it's quite as hard as alchemy in the 16th century. Alchemy is, I think, still hard. But it's pretty hard to take the complexity of what we do as human beings and put this into, computer systems, because at the end of the day, computers are just rocks, right? Silicon is just sand. It's just a rock. So if we're going to put brain power into rocks, take some extra work. So one way that we're looking at this would be many, many talks, and many of you, as I have spent our entire careers doing this, but one way of looking at how do you make IT do the things we would like IT to do is something. Here's an example of bed handoffs. I think Dr. Blick showed this morning the steps in doing labs at his clinical chemistry lab. You can do some pretty amazing and scary flow charts that show all the kinds of clinical workflows. This is on bed turnaround. When I was practicing medicine full-time in Boston, the bed shortage, after all the hospitals were told to close beds, there are too many beds, there's too many hospitals. Then in the mid to late 90s, then we didn't have enough beds. And so we would have our nurse managers every morning at 11 a.m. throughout the hospital meet and try to figure out who could be discharged that day to scrape up extra beds, a very inefficient activity. If you could take a couple of these things, like notifying admissions, the patient's about to be discharged, notifying housekeeping that the person has left, or in between, notifying the ambulance service to pick up a patient, or arranging for the home oxygen, or letting the emergency department know that a bed is available for somebody who's been boarding in the hallway to be admitted. If we can computerize any of these many human handoffs, that's a big win. Just as an aside, you know it's a really bad ER shift when the people you admitted the day before are still in the ER? Now, I wouldn't ever blame that on lab, you know, because radiology must have taken just as long. But, yeah, I tell you, it's just thought-provoking. You have some poor person, you know, and they're Johnny. Of course, we don't really have blankets to speak of. You know, all hospital sheets are just a little shorter than the mattress and have nothing to stick to the mattress, so they're guaranteed to fall off. So the patient's lying on that hard black plastic for the entire duration. If we could do anything in our back office world to make that more efficient in handoffs, a big win. And is there a way to do that? Well, of course, you know the answer. I wouldn't be talking if there weren't. And there are multiple technologies out there, but one of the most interesting is something called workflow engines. So in a lot of other businesses in the United States, you take all the different steps in your processes, all the activities, and you can start monitoring them step by step. You decompose them into steps, and you start monitoring by steps, and then you track whether the step happened. So a feedback loop, if you will. Did this happen? If not, how do I escalate? That technology, we use a vendor called Staffware now, TIBCO. It's called a workflow engine. Microsoft, IBM, BEA, they all have products that do this type of stuff. Looks very much like a Visio flowchart. Now, there's a lot of complexity here, but the only reason I mention this is the type of IT that we think is going to combine all of these modern imaging and technologies, whether they're from the pathology and lab department or whether they're from, you know, imaging anatomically, the classic images we know about. How does this show up at the user? Well, a lot of it's automatic, but some of it just shows up. This is a new IT product we have called Saurian. It just shows up as a to-do list, as an automated to-do list, sequenced and prioritized, first in healthcare IT, to do this kind of computerization on your to-do list. It's not maybe arguably the most stunning thing in the world, but it's never been done before. Lots of these tasks, of course, are best done by computers alone without human intervention. And so if you build computing environments, you can change what we're doing and change that sort of endless sea of paper and phone calls and errors that are the part. What are the kinds of workflows? I mean, they're everything. It can be seen as a workflow. Here's an interesting one that merges in vivo and in vitro. So if somebody has ectopic parathyroid adenoma, you can do things like PTH testing in vitro, intra-SPECT CT. Then intraoperatively, you can repeat the PTH test, see if you remove the adenoma. I mean, this is just one sort of little example, but this is really what I think all of our joint lives are going to be, getting these kind of opportunities and step-by-step automating them. Now, the last thing I want to mention, the presentation so far, mostly what I've talked about, is really about the science of information and the volumes of information and combining information. And that you can sort of predict, because Moore's law is actually pretty predictable. What I certainly can't predict, and maybe somebody out there can, is these are also fundamentally disruptive technologies. When I practice medicine today, it's really sort of look at the patient, listen to the signs, and, you know, listen to their symptoms, do a physical exam, what are the signs, do some tests. But it really, we're only looking at a tiny substrate of down the road potentially biologically available information with these technologies as they come on board. All of these technologies are fundamentally disruptive to the go see your doctor, go to the big hospital, get sick, get treated, disease-based world that American medicine is and medicine globally. If we could actually do these preventive things, even in part, we may very much change the world. I would recommend anybody who has an interest in the economics of this, there's a wonderful new book out by Michael Porter, who wrote the big competitive advantage and strategy books. He's a business school professor at Harvard. Has written just a great book on adding value to patients. Another way to put this is, what would patients actually pay for if they had to pay for it directly out of pocket and could shop. This is also public policy. Michael Levitt, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, has a big initiative to make pricing transparency and outcome transparency U.S. policy. So I think you're going to see this brave new world that you know, companies like Siemens are entering really in a very different economic model as we re-enter market economies, as the deductibles go up and the costs escalate. And I think you're going to see that the in vitro and in vivo diagnosis is really going to drive much more of what goes on in healthcare than the classic sort of history and physical exam. So let me conclude. You know, I think the points to make are there is both economically and scientifically a merger of in vitro and in vivo information. This is information that's happening at a molecular level. We're talking about very high-dimensional data, so not a single analyte, not a single plain film X-ray. High-dimensional data, integrated data, the growth curves of the ability to find the data and analyze the data are extremely predictable. Moore's law, computing power doubles every 18 months. Now, the medical things may not exactly double every 18 months, but on average, we should have every 18 months or something around that time frame a qualitative change, and certainly a quantitative change in what we can do. The amount of data to analyze will be huge. It's increasingly huge. We think information technology and computer science are going to be the drivers of that, and that these things are going to be centralized to that vision of personalized preventive care. And with that, this is the splanchnic circulation in a 64-slice CT scan, and hopefully I've gotten a little blood flow from your gut here to your brain. Thank you very much.